Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, we view the history and expressive power of the flute.
Any wind instrument was a masculine instrument. In the 1700s, men's walking sticks would sometimes convert the top part so they could stroll with their companion and then stop and serenade her with their flute.
Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra's principal flutist, Dorley McQuain, talks about her instrument's range and an upcoming concert. We also hear from KUAC's math guy about one possible way to elevate political discourse.
The reason Plato wanted his students to learn geometry wasn't so that they could go out and construct better bridges or faster missiles. He saw in geometry there was a beautiful example of a way of thinking where assumptions were clearly stated, definitions were clearly stated, and ideas progressed in a meaningful way.
And Chris Lott is in with Cachexit Clippings. I hope you'll stick around. Whether etched in stone in the American Southwest, depicted on antique Greek pottery, or painted on Egyptian papyrus, images of humans playing flutes are among the oldest in world history. Archaeologists have unearthed flutes dating back 9,000 years, and by playing one of them, researchers found the seven-holed instrument, carved from a bird's thigh bone, was pitched roughly a modern octave. As you'll hear on today's show, the flute continues to stretch the limits of musical expression. This coming Saturday, the Fairbanks flutists present their 39th concert. The ensemble's director, Dorley McQuain, has served as principal flutist for the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra since 1974 and been a UAF Music Department faculty member since 1981. That's also the year she formed the Fairbanks Flutist. I used the occasion of this Saturday's concert to learn more about an instrument that has played such a vital and enduring role in world music. I also wanted some questions answered. I began my conversation with Dorley by asking why a metal flute is classified as a woodwind.
The flute originally was wood. In fact, it was wood until, halfway through the 1800s. And some of the first metal flutes, according to Gordon Wright anyway, were introduced into the orchestra. And Wagner was conducting one of his own pieces, heard the metal flute for the first time, and said, "Get those cannons out of my orchestra." Which seems really bizarre considering what Wagner's music sounds like.
That's right. I mean, it's so bombastic that you'd think he'd love that. The other thing that always strikes me is I've seen ancient pictures of flutes, and of course they're kind of like recorders are today. But you say the transverse flute came in before Bach's time, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, without keys. There are a lot of Chinese flutes, probably ancient, also current, where they're wood, but they are also played transversely. And they get a different kind of tone. And of course, it's produced in a different way. It's like blowing across a pop bottle or blowing across reeds like pan pipes. They're held vertically, but you play them by blowing across the hole instead of into something like a recorder. The ones you blow straight into are called fipple flutes or flute a bec. It has kind of a beaked mouthpiece that you actually put into your mouth, and then the air goes down the tube and it's split by a little wedge partway down. That's why all recorders have a strange little square hole near the top, and that's where the air column is split. Whereas with the transverse flutes, the air column is split like the Coke bottle. It's split as you blow across it, not into it.
The other thing I think about with the flute is there's a lot of mechanisms on it as opposed to like the recorder where it just has holes in it.
Yeah, but even recorders, if you get into tenor and bass recorders, they're going to have one key for the lowest note. And that's the way the flute started too. Can't give you the era exactly, but starting considerably pre-Bach, there would be a one-keyed flute, and then there was a two-keyed flute, and so on and so on. And the original one and two keys were for some of the lowest notes because your fingers can only stretch so far, and then the keys came in so that you could play in more than one key, musical key, because you need sharps and flats to be able to do that. And when you play like an Irish penny whistle or the flutes that didn't have any keys, you can only play in whatever key that instrument is pitched in. You can only play in the key of G if it's a G recorder, or only in the key of F. And then when you got right around the time of Bach, that's what his well-tempered clavier was all about, and being able to play in any key. And then you get woodwind instruments that had a lot of keys so that they could be played chromatically. But everybody had a different system. Country to country had different systems, and flute maker to flute maker had different systems. And the guy who's famous is Theobald Baim. He was a musician and an inventor, and he basically came up with the key system that flutes use today.
I know you're about to, this summer, go to an annual conference. And I always think of these kind of conventions and conferences, they unveil the latest and greatest. Is that what happens with the flute?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't turn over as fast as, say, the computer industry does. But let's start with metals, first of all. You have the student model flutes, which are alloys of various inexpensive metals. And then you have the sterling silver, and then you have gold, and it can range anywhere from 7K up to 25K gold flutes, and then there are platinum flutes.
Gold is so heavy. It's not solid gold, is it?
Yes. For example, you can have a 14-karat gold, solid gold flute, weighs less than a 25. I have played a 25-karat gold flute at the convention. I borrowed it from somebody, and I wouldn't want to play that for a really long time, but, you know, if I was 20 years old, sure, that would be great. But
you were pressing weights in the gym or something.
Yeah, but they do have different sounds based on the metal.
Yeah, and I've heard that gold is warmer than silver, but I think people who say that are going by the visual thing rather than the audio thing.
Talk to a scientist. Every tone that we hear in nature and instruments and voices is not just one pitch, but it's made up of a whole series of partials. For example, the difference between silver and gold is a gold flute has less to none of about the fourth partial. And so when you use the term warmer, and I usually say a gold flute sounds darker. Same thing. Silver flutes tend to sound brighter. And then platinum is missing even more of the higher partials, and it's even darker sounding.
When you flutists get together, do you say, that's a great flute?
Oh, yeah. I was listening to KUAC yesterday as I was driving home, and there was a flute concerto on, Baroque or early classical. And then I realized partway through that it was being played on a modern wood flute. And I can tell it's wood because of a little maybe raspiness, but basically what we're talking about is the partials. It had more of the overtone, the higher partials, than even a silver flute would do. That's how you can, when you're listening to something, you can tell the difference between a recorder and a flute. Or why an oboe playing a melody sounds different from a flute or a violin. They're playing exactly the same pitches, but it's all about the partials.
Thank you. The other thing that I know, you're a tremendously great runner, and I think about breath control. That must be key for flutists, isn't it?
It is key for any woodwind player. And it's interesting that some famous flutists of the past have claimed that because they were great swimmers, it really helped their breath control. The key thing there is control. Mm-hmm. It's the breath control, not taking it in, letting it out, lip control, posture, all that. You know, I've had some students with phenomenal control who were not particularly athletic, and others that were extremely athletic that all the pieces didn't really come together.
I want to now turn to, you mentioned this concerto for the flute, and as a concerto instrument, the modern flute seems to be a really great instrument because it can work with the orchestra back and forth like the concerto form does. Earlier flutes, did they have that same sort of power and presence?
No, but it is interesting that the flute was extremely popular in the 1700s for all sorts of concerti. Of course, the other instruments weren't that loud then either. And most early flute concerti are written just for flute and string orchestra.
Okay.
And perhaps it was super popular because it was very popular with the ruling class in Europe.
Wasn't some king?
Yes, yes. Carl de Grosse. Equance was his court composer and his flute teacher, and he played the flute. So maybe everybody wanted to play the flute. Who knows? And back then, any wind instrument was a masculine instrument.
What do you mean by that?
Only men played them.
Wow.
Women were to be playing the harp and the harpsichord and those sort of things.
Interesting.
And for example, in the 1700s, men's walking sticks would sometimes convert, the top part could convert into a flute, so they could stroll with their companion and then stop and serenade her with their flute. Then during the 1800s, when the concerto form was really popular and you have Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and Brahms, well, Beethoven's on the early part, none of them wrote concertos for flutes. I would guess that part of that's because the orchestras got so much louder. And even today, the flute can't compete in volume with even a violin, let alone a trumpet. So anyway, there are very few flute concertos in the 1800s.
Hmm.
And then it gradually became more popular again in the 1900s and now into our century. But despite its evolution, it still is one of the softer instruments. It has one of the smallest dynamic ranges. I mean, a clarinet and a violin can play as soft as a flute, but they can both play much louder, no matter who the flutist is.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with Fairbanks flutist Dorley McQuain about her instrument and her ensemble, which has a concert coming up this Saturday at Davis Concert Hall. When we return, playing a solid gold flute. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This show, I'm talking with Dorley McQuain, the founder and director of the Fairbanks Flutists. The group has a free concert this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Davis Concert Hall. Let's return to our conversation. Are there pieces of music that flutists all agree that's a great showcase piece?
Oh, maybe, but I doubt you could get a group of flutists to agree on anything, just like you can't get a group of anybody
to agree on it.
Because everybody has their likes and dislikes. Some people like very modern music, very avant-garde, what's called extended techniques, things that people weren't doing 50 years ago, making very strange noises on the flute, making what the equivalent of double stops on a flute, playing chords. Now, of course, you can't tune those chords to what you want. You can only play what comes out with a certain fingering. But there is a class of piece called showpieces that showcase the flashier aspects of the flute. So there's that category as opposed to the more serious classical. This is a composer called Reinecke. He wrote a concerto and sonatas for flute that would be the equivalent of if Brahms had written a concerto for flute. And then you have beatboxing flute these days. That's really big.
Help me there. Well, what is that?
That's where you finger the flute, but you, across the mouthpiece, get to do all those cha-cha-cha-cha. And there's a guy named Greg Patillo. He's sort of the guy that started it. And he does the coolest things. He will take Peter and the Wolf. The dun 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 dun. And he'll be like, dun 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 dun.
Whoa.
And it's, I've taken a class with him and I've with some other people. It's, you really kind of have to specialize in that. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And especially the way he combines it. He's in a group called Project Trio. You can look them up on YouTube there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, before we turn to your concert, back to the symphony orchestra, are there classical pieces of music, while it's not a concerto, have passages that capitalize on the flutes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. Even in as a background instrument with a concerto, Dvorak's cello concerto, I joke, is a concerto for cello and flute. Tchaikovsky wrote a piece, Rococo Variations for Cello, where the cello and the flute are doing duets in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Brahms, in his first symphony, has echoes between the French horn and the flute. The French horn does this big, slow, gorgeous solo, and then the flute answers.
Those 17th and 18th century composers that did write concerti for the flute are some really wonderful expressions of that instrument's power or expressive quality that just push the limit in technique.
Of the early one, possibly, and in fact, tying your question into our upcoming concert with the Fairbanks flutists, Vivaldi wrote numerous concertos for flute and for piccolo. And one of them is called Il Gardellino, which is the goldfinch, and we're going to do the goldfinch concerto with just flutes on our upcoming concert, and they're very technical.
When you put together a concert with just flutists, are there pieces of music that you customarily go to, or do you commission them or adapt other pieces?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Yes. I've adapted some mostly from all string pieces. Like, for example, Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, which is only for strings. I've arranged it so that it's only flutes. So we have the C flutes play the first and second violin part, the alto plays the viola part, and the bass flute plays the cello part. There's that as an adaptation for sure. And when I started Fairbanks Flutists in 1981, there weren't too many pieces for multiple flute parts. I could buy a few and then arrange a few things and then just take quartets. There's always been lots of flute quartets. And even back in the 1700s and 1800s, a Frenchman named Bois Mortier wrote concerti for five flutes. So we got to do those. And then we've got more modern pieces that I've bought and pieces that, for example, John Luther Adams wrote a piece for us, which we're also doing on this concert because it's called Strange Birds, and so we're concentrating on birds, so we have his piece. And Emerson Eads wrote a piece about the four seasons of the tern, the bird, the tern. So, yes, we have pre-arranged pieces, written for the flute pieces, and written for us pieces.
Now, of course, with a string quartet, we know we have two violins, a viola, and a cello. Talk to me about the different voices of the flute.
On the top, you have the piccolo, which is, think Stars and Stripes. No matter how many flutes you have in your ensemble or orchestra, there's generally only one piccolo. Then the bulk would be well, C flutes, which is the standard flute. Then you have alto, which is in the key of G, so it's a fourth lower, and that takes the place of the violas. Mm. Then you have the bass flute, which is an octave below the C flute, and that's all we have here. Then there are contralto flutes, which are an octave lower than the altos, contrabass flutes, which are an octave lower than the bass, and subcontrabass flutes, which are two octaves lower.
What are they, modified tubas?
Well, they look like the number four. It would go from the bottom up to the top, curve back as a four, and you would be blowing on the part of the four that's horizontal instead of the vertical part. And standing, of course.
Talk about breath control. To move that column of air
must
be a
challenge. Yeah, you only get a few notes on every breath. Because, again, physics, the piccolo is half as short as a C flute. Then the bass flute is twice as long as a C flute, and it curves back on itself. You can't hold a bass flute out to the side, but you do hold it horizontally with a big curve. And then to get a contrabass flute, it has to be twice as big as that. So it has to stand. And by the time you get down to the subcontras, you've got something that's sticking up 7 feet in the air and curving around on itself.
Yeah. Well, and that sort of reminds me of that Pythagorean ratio that you divide the string in half and then you have an octave higher.
Yes, that's right. Or you double the length of the string and it's going to go down.
Yeah. Let's go to the pieces on your concert. What do you look for, Dorley, in composing a concert like this?
Well, let me just be specific with this year's concert,
sure.
For example. It's called For the Birds. There is no end to literature that was written for flute that has something to do with bird. It's kind of a joke. Think Peter and the Wolf. So what I've assembled is a number of pieces about birds that include something classical, something modern and tonal, and something that's way out there.
Well, and are there composers today that you find really have a good ear for the flute and its range?
Oh, yeah. Even though John Luther Adams is no longer composing in the style of the piece he wrote for us, it is called Strange Birds Passing. And the interesting thing about it is it evokes a northern atmosphere without specifically saying, this is a bird. It's a very ephemeral sense of being rather than this is a bird. However, we are doing Vivaldi's The Goldfinch, which is a bird.
That's a bird.
We're doing a piece by a contemporary composer called Beyond the Black Stump, which is about Australia. Evidently, we always think that Australia is like Alaska and they talk about out in the bush. Well, evidently, if you really live in the boonies in Australia, you're beyond the black stump. And there's a lot of didgeridoo-like effects, but then there are specific references to different sounding birds from Australia.
Interesting.
In parts of the piece.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dorley McQuain, founder of the Fairbanks Flutists. The ensemble is offering a concert Saturday evening called For the Birds. When we return from this break, we'll hear about growing up with music. Back to Northern Soundings. Let's return to my conversation with Dorley McQuain, faculty member of the UA of Music Department and principal flutist for the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra. I know you're a teacher. When did you decide this was the instrument for you, Dorla? You came from, your parents were musicians.
They were.
What instruments did they play?
My father played piano, organ, viola, and cello.
Oh, wow.
And my mother mostly played violin and viola. And he was a professional educator and went on to be the director of instrumental music in the Pittsburgh schools.
Holy smokes.
And I'm fairly positive that from a very young age, people who were talking to them and me would say, and what instrument you play? And I would go, nothing. And when it was time to pick an instrument in fourth grade, I picked nothing. And then in fifth grade, I did pick the flute. And in retrospect, the only reason I can think I picked that is it was an instrument that my parents did not play.
Interesting. I'll bet. Well, it was defining yourself as, But you must have heard music from your earliest years.
Yes,
you must
yes.
have been steeped in
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah. And they would go to friends' house and play string quartets with friends. And as a 3, 4, 5-year-old, I would go with them and, you know, they'd take my pajamas and put me to sleep on somebody else's couch, and then they'd play their string quartets. And
well, you must have developed an ear through that, do you think?
Possibly.
Possibly.
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah.
Which is one of those subliminal unconscious things, which is really good.
Yeah.
Which is basically the basis of the Suzuki method, is just have kids hear stuff from a very young age, and it just becomes part of you without having to say, I'm going to sit down and figure out what a sounds like.
Mm-hmm. You hear about pianists who say, I studied with so-and-so, who studied with so-and-so,
right.
and there's
the pedigree.
The pedigree. Are there pedigrees for the flute?
Oh, absolutely. I gave up the flute for high school and college, thought I was going to become an art conservator, and came up here as a break in 74, and I'm still here. the famous flute teachers go back to the French Conservatory School, and people trace their lineage from there. And then some came to the United States. Some supposedly branched off, and others still stayed true to it. And the most famous ones, like I say, were French, going up through a man named Marcel Moïse. He was sort of the last of the one-of-a-kind flute pedagogues. And then there's all sorts who here. William Kincaid was at Curtis in Philadelphia. And then it's kind of like a family tree. As it gets spread out, then there are almost too many to,
sure.
to name after that.
What kind of latitude do you have in playing the flute to explore those avenues?
In terms of tone, you have the style and speed of vibrato versus no vibrato. You have the basic articulation, which is tonguing in the flute, and it's even the position of the tongue in your mouth. The French European language and Italian, the tongue is much farther forward than German and English. And so they tongue literally from touching the lips in front of the teeth, and most Americans tongue behind the top teeth. But there really is a difference, and it's usable in different places in the same continent. You can use them differently. And then the more these extended techniques come in, there's flutter tonguing, where it's kind of the opposite of tonguing. You're actually sticking your tongue into the tone hole instead of taking it away. So like instead of going pa, you're going hut, which kids pick up really quickly, and we call them frog noises. So they can make these little
teacher, what do you hope your students get besides love of music and love of the instrument? What do you strive for as a teacher?
Well, I guess it depends if we're getting technical or not. I mean, on the technical side, control of the air, the fingers, the tone.
Mm-hmm.
On the musical side, expressing, as I tell the younger kids, full sentences in music and the idea you're trying to get across. And in the big picture, getting along with other people. You know, I mean, I'm really into ensemble. I mean, that's my thing, is into ensemble playing.
For successful ensembles, it strikes me, you totally have to listen to the other players and respond. And there's a certain tension and dynamic at play there in performance.
Yeah, and tension, dynamic, but also cohesion and and sense of belonging and unification. And
I love the string quartet form and on those pieces where one instrument kind of rises and then subsides back into it. It's so lovely to see that dynamic and that flow going on.
And you do, you know, you just have to listen and adapt. On a tangent, one thing especially wind instruments can do, strings can do also, pianos can't because it's a fixed pitched instrument, is we can change the same written note depending on its position within a chord. And this gets back to the earlier discussion about partials and overtones, because every note has basic, like a C, has basically a C major chord set of overtones in it, but when, which is C, E, G. But if you switch to an E chord or a G chord, those E's and G's shouldn't be in the same place that they were in for the C chord to make it really ring. Like that's what in the old days they called it, the chord of nature or the harmony of the spheres. And then Bach came along with his equal-tempered clavier and just flat out evened every note out to a different pitch in its own specific pitch, which made the instrument far more versatile, but less in this harmony of the spheres.
How they were tuned was like a little secret.
Well, because they were tuned more to what's called just intonation, this natural intonation, which meant that there wasn't equal space between notes. So those pieces didn't modulate from one key to another very much. They would, if they started in the key of G, they were in the key of G. They could maybe go to the key of D, but they'd have to basically be there. They could, in other words, they could never go from the key of G to the key of A flat because it would sound horrendously out of tune. But when they were in the key of G, it would sound magical.
Let's say nobody's come to one of your concerts before. What should they be prepared to listen for?
We're going to do some pieces. For example, a Hovhaannes piece called Birds in a Magic Forest. It's basically a canon for 20 flutes. We're going to do another piece by a Finnish composer, which one of the parts, you only play the head joint. You don't even use the rest of the flute.
And I often think for any performing art, the audience really does play a role in any given performance, because how they react and how they tend to the piece really has a subtle influence on it.
Or not so subtle. If what do we hear about the first performances of Rite of Spring? I think people were throwing spoiled vegetables.
Well, let's let that doesn't hope happen on your May 18th concert. Well, Dorley McWane, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you.
Saturday's concert for the Birds is scheduled at 8 p.m. at the Davis Concert Hall. I'll have links to Dorley McWane and the Fairbanks Flutist on the Northern Soundings homepage. When we return, math and politics.
Thank you.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. My friends know I was a philosophy undergraduate, and I still turn to past thinkers when I'm puzzling over current affairs. That had me recently turning to the 17th century English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, best known for his political work Leviathan. Before I could delve into his thoughts about the social contract, I was distracted by the discovery Hobbes was also a serious scientist and mathematician. So I asked KUAC's math guy John Gimbelian for a look at the connection between math and politics. As he explains, Hobbes came to mathematics relatively late in his life.
This story, perhaps apocryphal, is he was in a gentleman's club in London, and first volume of Euclid was laid open there to Euclid's 47th proposition, and he started reading it. This is the Pythagorean theorem. And he had to turn back a few pages because it referenced some previous work. And when he got to that, he had to go back further. And he delved further and further, and he became a mathematician, essentially. We think of him as a philosopher, but he also wrote quite a bit of mathematics. He went off to Paris, became friends with Mersenne, which is a name that, you know, not too many people recognize, but for us old timers who learned to use slide rules, we recognize that name and the Mersenne primes. And he also got to meet Galileo and have some conversations with him. He was intrigued by a number of the unsolved problems in mathematics. And I'll tell you about one that really intrigued him, and that was the notion of squaring the circle. So you're given the diameter of a circle, say as a straight line, a line segment, and you want to somehow construct a square that has the same surface area as the circle. You're only allowed a straight line, a compass. Those are the only two things that you're given. And it used to be a very, very big problem. And in his first mathematical text, he included proof of squaring the circle. And fortunately, before it went to the publishers, somebody pointed out an error in the proof. And he left it in the book nonetheless, but he added, from a false hypothesis, a false quadrature. He actually lived a lot longer than most people did in the 17th century. He lived to 91, and at the time of his death, he was working on another proof for squaring the circle, and it wasn't for, 150 years later, they finally proved that it couldn't be done. As you know, oftentimes in math, proving something can be done is a lot easier than showing that it can't be done.
Well, you know, it strikes me, John, that while I was looking up Hobbes as a political philosopher, didn't know his connection with mathematics, but it seems math has been influential throughout Western culture for a great many thinkers.
Oh, yeah. Plato had over the archway to his academy this quote, "Let no one enter here ignorant of geometry." And this, by the way, is over the doorway to my office, so though I have it in Greek, so people don't feel
so a mini academy here at the UAF.
Exactly, yeah. And the reason Plato wanted his students to learn geometry wasn't so that they could go out and construct better bridges or faster missiles or how we oftentimes justify it in our geometry text today. It's because he saw in geometry there was a beautiful example of a way of thinking where assumptions were clearly stated, definitions were clearly stated, and ideas progressed in a meaningful way. And it goes on, you're right, throughout history. Really notable example is with the founders of the United States. Many of them were lovers of geometry. Thomas Jefferson said it was the first love of his life. He encountered it when he was a student at William and Mary, and then in his retirement, he went back to reading Euclid, and he said it gave him a lot more joy than reading the newspapers. And you can see this in the Declaration of Independence. Near the very top, it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." These are the axioms that we're laying down for this discussion with you, dear King.
Well, and but I know this idea of clear and distinct ideas as essential building blocks has been around in philosophy, at least in how we think, how we reason. Did it continue in the 20th century, too?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Perhaps stronger at the start than the finish, but you had groups like the logical positivists. There was a fellow Italian, Giuseppe Peano, who worked very hard at foundations of mathematics, foundations of logic, and undergraduates who study this material, they all learn the Peano axioms. And he eventually left mathematics to go into linguistics. They were working on a language called interlingua. And the idea was this, that in mathematics, you rarely see mathematicians resort to fistfights to resolve issues. I mean, you could either convince someone that you're right or they can convince you. And they thought, wouldn't this be a great model for human intercourse where we just eliminated all of the ambiguities, we clearly stated our definitions, and that they hoped it would bring world peace. And then along a few decades later, you've got Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein.
Oh, sure.
Who actually started out in mathematics and engineering, and he began to contemplate these things. He wrote his Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, in which he tried to lay out an order where, again, we could just eliminate from language ambiguities and, as a result, conflict. He later changed his mind and he said, nah, that's all crazy. We ought to try to study what people mean rather than trying to force them, because language, after all, is a very living thing and you can't just set it in stone.
Well, hearing you talk, John, I wonder if our political discourse wouldn't be improved if we limited tweets to axioms first and then you could go on to make statements.
There's always hope, Robert. Always hope.
John Gimbel is a mathematician who teaches at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's known as the KUAC math guy and comes by periodically. Thanks, John.
Always good to see you, Robert.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. When we return, Chris Lott explores what's in a name with another edition of Cachexit Clippings. Here's Chris.
I recently had the pleasure of attending my first roller derby bout. Shout out to Kid Vicious and the rest of the Victoria, BC-based Rotten Apples who invaded Rat City. And though the actual sport bore little resemblance to my only previous idea of it, which was based on the deadly game and the mid-70s film Rollerball, it was great fun nevertheless. I enjoyed many things about the event, not least the inclusivity, pageantry, and unapologetically in-your-face attitude. But as a lover of puns, a punthusiast, if you will, or a paranomasiac, if you must, I was particularly captivated by the derby names. On the Rotten Apples team alone were found the aforementioned Kid Vicious, and teammates Black Eye Suze, Scream Soda, and the perfectly Canadian-monikered Tuffy St. Marie, all led by Coach Regrettel. I promise not to spend this whole segment doing nothing but listing the punniest names. The only rival for my affection for a name based on a great pun is one based on a really terrible one, but I could. Derby names based on pop culture forms and universes predominate. Examples inspired by video games, musicians, comic characters, and fictional franchises are everywhere. For instance, Harry Potter fans can create an all-star team with the likes of Hermione Danger, Luna Shevgood, Maul Weasley, Bellatrix Lepain, and of course, Minerva McGonagall. But derby names know no bounds. My author dream team at the moment would be recorded in a book by Sylvia Rath, Malice Walker, and Zora Neale Hurston. If you've had the misfortune of meeting a favorite author and being disappointed and thus prefer their creations instead, then how about a roster including Mary Choppins, Payne Eyre, Violent Beauregard, and Pippi Longstompings? And many derby names aren't based on people or characters at all, but are just plain awesome, like Tara Armoff, Gefilte Fists, and naturally, my so far favorite, Oxford Kamikaze. As you might expect in a sport that embraces all genders and sexual orientations, a scan of roller derby rosters will also reveal a variety of names based on sex and anatomy, whose delights I leave you to discover on your own. The bottom line is, roller derbyists, in explicitly choosing names that fit with the sport's body positivity, gender fluidity, and aggressive athletic camaraderie, are both taking part in a fascinating social system with its own complex rules and norms, see Dave Fagundes' article Talk Derby to Me for much more, and becoming intuitive students of onomastics, or the study of proper names. Onomastics comes from the Greek onoma, a name, and ultimately from the Proto-Indo-European root nomen, from which we derive many words obviously related to names and naming, such as nominate and moniker, and others whose connection is less obvious, including onomatopoeia, synonym, antonym, homonym, and all the rest of the nims that bedeviled me in grade school and now. Onomasticians are often linguists, but amongst their ranks you will also find psychologists, philosophers, historians, anthropologists, and theologians. This is because onomastics covers a wide range of interests around the history, patterns, and influence of names and naming, in everything from advertising and brand names to mythological and religious traditions of all sorts, historical and contemporary. And names and the power of naming are constant critical threads across cultures, traditions, and mythologies. In ancient times, the power to name something or someone was often an act of authority, endowing human beings with dominion over the earth. We see this worked out broadly in the mystical, magical, and philosophical idea of true names, names that are usually highly guarded and kept secret, reserved for use in important rituals if the names are known at all. And similarly in many religious traditions, including Jewish rituals around the disposal of documents with sacred names written on them, the Christian stories of Adam naming the animals, and Islam's 99 names of God, to name just a few. More down to earth, the naming of places and peoples, particularly as part of the long history of human migration and colonization, is a thriving area of onomastic study. Beneath the names chosen, given, adopted, forced, and rejected, in every change, from claiming a new name or reclaiming an old one, right down to seemingly simple changes of spelling, and lurking inside every toponym, endonym, demonym, and exonym, are fascinating stories and usually bloody political lessons we can hope to learn from. But besides renaming ourselves, the only time most people have a chance to exercise the ancient power of naming is when naming pets and children. Whether one of these is a subcategory of the other, and if so, which is which, I leave as an exercise for later. And here onomastics goes well beyond books and surveys of baby names, as interesting as those are, and deep into matters real and imagined, from married and family names and the naming practices of groups and gangs, to the manner and meaning of name choices and fictions of all sorts. The onomastic rabbit hole from which I have most recently emerged is the question of nominative determinism, the idea that people gravitate towards work that suits their name. Spotting names that match someone's profession can be fun. Real-life examples include Igor Judge, the Chief Justice of England and Wales, lawyer Sue Yu, ornithologist Mitchell Bird, dentist Randall Toothaker, and the urologist specializing in vasectomies, Dr. Richard Dick Chop. but research into the broader supposition of nominative determinism, whether people named Baker more often become bakers or people with names similar to anatomical parts become doctors, is unclear, despite in the latter case a fine paper authored by, and you can't make this stuff up, researchers Lim. For more on onomastics, including links to the papers I mentioned by Fagundes and the Four Limbs, a link to Arthur C. Clarke's legendary short story, The 9 Billion Names of God, and other pointers where I name names, surf over to kateksik.com/KUAC.
That's it for this Northern Sounding. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. To close out the show, we'll return to the flute and Dorley McWane's arrangement of Gluck's Minuet and Dance of the Blessed Spirits, performed by the National Flute Choir. Information about the music you heard on today's show can be found on the Northern Sounding site. Until next time, thanks for listening.